Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Watch out. Big bad Green Bernie could be watching you right now as you listen to ABC Radio National and The Science Show. Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and this is a nano science show with a little of everything small, including the ABC's attempt to reduce its waste and its footprint below the visible. And it's being launched this week. Bernie Hobbs, how?
Grant Work is doing two things. First of all, it's exposing what we are doing reality show style for all of Australia to keep track of us and make sure that when we say we're going green at the ABC, we've got the stats there for everyone to look at and they can check up on us. So that's one thing. We're just exposing ourselves. The other thing is we thought, well, while we're going through it, while we're looking at all the things that are hard, the things that could be done easier, the things that help along the way, let's put together a bit of a toolkit for anyone else who wants to go green at their work. So if you want to go green at work, you can go to our site and everything you need is there, whether it's just simple things you can do or whether it's how to change the culture of your organisation. Or if you want to know how to get that guy in accounting to turn his computer off, send us your question. We'll send an answer. We'll track down the experts and get onto it for you. So all the dirt is there, a little bit of fun on the side.
We'll come to the dirt and the fun. First of all, the structure. As you walk around the ABC, do you get the kind of palpitations that I do about how really decrepit this place is, with hundreds of lights on all the time, with lashings of material just wasted?
It's appalling. I mean, you know, my mother grew up in the Depression, so I was brought up recycling margarine containers from 1965. So, I can't stand waste. But I think our building isn't decrepit. We've got some absolutely beautiful features of it, but it does blow me away that people leave a studio, leave the lights turned on, people leave work at night. And I think it's partly because all of the switches operate, you know, the vast part of a floor, and you don't know if you're going to turn one off, if someone from background briefing is going to come, you know, yelling at you any second.
Do you know, that's why I actually took the lights out of the socket.
I don't have any. You have been a leader in this field for some time, Williams, because not only that, you've established your own compost heap in that disgusting plant that you can barely see for the fruit flies in one corner of your office and underneath the stuffed turkey or whatever it is. But, you know, you're an exception. You were an early adopter here. But I think it's not the people that are setting out to do wrong or do bad. It's just people take the easiest path. And because things haven't been set up and there hasn't been a focus on cutting energy in the culture of the place, it hasn't been on everyone's minds. And that's just starting to change now, because what you really need to change the way people think is you need a message coming, a strong message coming from on top. You really need it to infiltrate the culture from top down. So we've got that now. We've got a commitment from Mark Scott to cut the ABC's emissions.
Yeah.
He is the managing director. He's the one who set us on the green path. Although, having said that, he's the one who said, because we're a government organisation, for the last 10 years we've had to undertake the same efficiency measures that everyone else has. Not that any of us know about it, but our engineers, you know, those guys who ferret around down on the lower ground there, they've managed to cut our emissions by nearly 27% in 10 years without any of us even knowing. None of us have noticed a thing. Certainly, they've done that just by making things happen more efficiently. So the ABC, along with other government buildings, has been doing this great thing without us knowing. All that easy stuff's been done just about now. So now it's down to the rest of us to get off our asses and start switching lights off, start turning computers off, doing those things that are so basic and you get so sick of hearing. But it takes earth hour to realise, I was here Saturday night, left at 5 to 8 trying to finish this website. And I left because I thought, well, I can't be sprung for having lights on at the ABC during earth hour. And, you know, I tried to set off one set of lights down the corridor, couldn't find the bloody switch. There is no way of knowing who operates or where the lights are operated from for background briefing. So
astonishing, yeah. Now, there's a tiny touch of the Gestapo about this. Now, you've given me a card which enables me to dob someone in.
Yeah.
How does this work?
Well, it's a part of the site called Busted, and it really is just trying to do it in a fun way rather than just nagging someone, rather than doing what other people do and put sticky tape over the power button on your colleague's computer to annoy the hell out of them. You know, it's just a lighthearted way of busting someone for doing the wrong thing. So we've set the tone a bit by busting a few ABC celebrities. You may or may not be on the list of subjects in
right.
coming episodes, Robin.
You can't give me names.
Well, I can name straight away. We've already busted Margaret Pomerantz, who I think, you know, looks as though she'd be absolutely delightfully green. That woman has got a sea of styrofoam cups underneath her desk that would float a Pacific island.
And I think her earrings probably run on about 25 megahertz or whatever.
There could be an issue there, but you can watch me busting Margaret on the website. We also got those gorgeous Good Game Boys, the little 20-year-olds who run three computers to charge their little PlayStation or something. I don't know what's going on up there, but they were the power sink on level 9. So with Busted, we're just trying to take that Nazi element out, make it a bit of fun, and we've made these postcards where you can just tick a box and say whether it's because they've got more frequent flyers than Neil Armstrong or what have you, and leave it on their desk. And then on the back, five things they can do right now.
Yes, I must say I do a tiny bit of that myself, but don't look, don't look, don't look. How will viewers and listeners and people who look at the website follow this, track it, the public?
Okay, so the way to track it, well, if you go to the website right now, you'll see that we've got records of what the ABC has been doing for the last two financial years. So you'll go to a map of Australia. So the green room is the ABC section of it. You go to the map of Australia, you click on any site and you can see the energy, waste, water, transport stats for that. And you can see whether it's gone up or down. So we're doing it by financial year, which means in August this year, now that we're all actually trying to do something about it, we're going to see what kind of a difference we can make in this financial year. That data will go up in August. So nothing in those stats is going to change between now and August, but the stories about what's happening will be updated a couple of times a week in the green room as well. So you'll be able to see the latest there.
And other firms can watch us or help us?
Oh, help, yes.
Help.
I mean, we're certainly not out there saying we're one of these leading corporations who have really taken this challenge. And you know, there are plenty of organisations in Australia who are at the leading edge of this. We're not one of those. We're one of the also-rans, you know, the whole arse-elbow confusion factor. But we're trying to do our bit, just trying to show these are some of the mistakes we made. Please don't make the same ones. And these are some of the things we wish we knew earlier. Please know them. So, yeah, any help, gratefully accepted.
Saves waste, worth doing anyway. If I were to bust you, Bernie, what might be your secret indulgence?
Oh, I have to say, try as I might, I can't edit things on screen. I just need paper. So I do print on the back of other things, and we do have it set to duplex, but I have got an appalling amount of paper and just general rubbish, in fact, accumulated on my desk. Having said that, I don't think you should be casting the first stone because I've seen your desk, man, and it's no picnic. So yeah.
It's a compost. Paper. We said it's a compost. Thanks,
paper's
Bernie.
My crime.
You'll be back to keep us in touch.
Absolutely. See
Thanks.
You then.
Bernie Hobbs, see her on The New Inventors, ABC Television, and see the website at abc.net.au/greenatwork. And so to nano, getting bigger every week. We'll take a sprint through some of the leading nano research today, and the theme is international. Chunapati Jagadish is Professor of Physics at the ANU in Canberra, and this is what they're doing.
We are focusing on two main areas, Robin. One is quantum dots, and another one is nanowires. These quantum dots are small particles which are of nanometer scale, which behave quite differently with respect to their bulk form.
So how small is a dot?
Typically, they are about 10 nanometers in diameter. And where the classical physics fails and the quantum physics starts coming into picture, that's where these quantum dots behave quite differently. That's why we call them as quantum dots.
Okay, now describe what happens at the normal classical physics level and how does it change? What do the dots then do?
Whenever we take a particular material, it has got a certain property. For example, light emitted by a particular material, it should not be affected by the size of that material based on the classical physics. It will emit the same color of light irrespective of whether it is a huge piece of material or otherwise a tiny speckle of that material. But whereas the quantum physics tells you that whenever you go to the dimensions of few nanometers to a few tens of nanometers, and they start emitting light at different colors. For example, you can take the same material, you can make that material to emit blue light for a particular size, and if you increase the size of the same particle a little bit bigger, it starts emitting green light, and if you make it slightly bigger, it starts emitting the red light. So that means now you got an opportunity to be able to use the same material of different dimensions to be able to emit three different primary colors, so that will opens up a lot of new opportunities.
I bet it does. I'll come to the opportunities in a minute. What about the nanowires?
These nanowires are like one-dimensional structures. They are like cylinders. And the lengthwise, they could be few microns long, but the diameter is about few tens of nanometers to few nanometers. Again, these nanowires will act like the laser cavities, for example, to get light out of these particular nanowires, and they have unique properties.
Is this carbon-based?
No, these are particular. The ones which we are working on are based on gallium arsenide and indium arsenide. These are the group 3 and group 5 elements of the periodic table.
Of course, I heard that you can, in fact, use carbon to make many of these very, very small devices.
Yes, carbon nanotubes have found many new applications in terms of modifying the chirality of these nanotubes.
That's left or right?
It could be both ways. And the way you try to fold this graphene sheet, it can be conducting or otherwise it is semiconducting. So that means it can act like a metal or it could act like somewhere between a metal and an insulator. Mm. So in the process, they end up providing unique properties.
Well, you've established the kind of weird world it is down there, what with colour and flexibility and the sort of conducting that it can do. And you talked about the applications that might stem from this sort of work. What have you in mind for yourself?
In my own case, we are developing the technologies using these quantum dots, making quantum dot lasers, which could be used for ultra-fast optical communications using the optical fibers. Because smaller the size of the dots and faster the switching on and off you can get from these devices, so that means you can really send information much faster than current devices. In the case of the same quantum dots, we can also use them as infrared detectors, which can be used for medical imaging applications, say for example cancer detection, bushfire detection, and night vision. And even if you are using your computer chip and then you want to figure out while you are operating that computer chip where it is getting hot, by using these infrared cameras, you'll be able to really tell where these hot spots are taking place in these chips.
That's a range of application variety, isn't it? Have these been established? Have you got devices already made?
Yes, in the laboratory we've already demonstrated working quantum dot lasers and quantum dot infrared photodetectors. And we are now trying to integrate these multiple quantum dots operating at different wavelengths. So in other words, on the same chip, you can have different colors so that you can simultaneously send information through the optical fiber.
It's all happening down there, isn't it? Professor Jagadish at the ANU, and more from him in a minute, an Indian in Canberra. Anita Gowell has an Indian family but lives in Boston. Her work underlines the international nature of nano.
Interesting. Well, I was actually born in America. My parents came from India. As immigrants, I was born in Massachusetts, grew up in rural Mississippi, and went to Stanford for undergraduate, and then came to Harvard and MIT to do my MD, PhD, and never quite left.
The reason I ask you about that is because there's a link to India in this story. The way in which people in India, in the villages, have started to use mobile phones, a sort of modern technology, when all around them there's something far less technological. Give us the picture.
Well, it's remarkable to see villagers and rickshawwalas and even beggars using cell phones in India today. And I think it's an example of if you can bring the price of a technology cheap enough and affordable enough, and there's a huge unmet need in a population. There's a, for example, in India, there are north of 1 billion people, and there's a desire to communicate. The landline infrastructure is not there the way it is here in the Western world. So when things like mobile technology came along, and if you can drive down the price enough, you actually open up a huge market.
Which brings in something called radar, which is not the kind of device that they use in aeroplanes developed during the war in Britain, but something for healthcare. Describe it for us. How small is it?
Well, this is a technology called gene radar that my company has developed, where imagine a future cell phone-like device in which you could put a drop of blood or saliva in a little disposable strip, stick it into the device, and within a few minutes be able to read out what disease or infectious disease a person has.
How does it do it?
I can't tell you all the secret sauce right now. But it basically involves our ability to, at the very nanoscale and at the single molecule level, detect the signatures of DNA and RNA. At the molecular level, you get essentially a biological fingerprint of the organism very quickly.
Well, this is where you come in again, because your qualifications are in medicine and in physics.
Correct.
Was that an advantage?
Definitely. Without being a physicist and also looking at some of the biomedical problems from that context, I don't think it would have been possible to develop such an approach.
Were you actually directly involved in the research to make this object?
Yes. Well, for over 15 years, I've been working in this area, which now people call nanotechnology. And it really began over 15 years ago when I fell in love with this idea of molecular machines or nanomotors that read and write information in DNA. And really learning how they can be precision controlled. That's sort of where my intuition for looking at these biological machines from a physics context developed.
Does radar exist now?
Well, we have a first generation version that's under sort of product development, and the later generations are still under prototyping.
Will it be developed in America and India? Because you talked about a 750-acre plant near the Himalayas that you're going to be involved with.
Sure, absolutely. Actually, the vision is to do it symbiotically. In the U.S., we are doing certainly the prototyping and a lot of the innovation of the basic thing. In India, we plan to do scaled-up manufacturing, some of the clinical testing for the local markets, and other advanced R&D around the platform as you start to customize it to different diseases, for example, because in principle, it's a platform technology that could be used for any kind of bug or virus. And then that information can be used to not only drive down the cost of production, but also to tailor it to local markets, to build an emerging market, to harness the local population, for example, in India, but also you have a testbed ecosystem in which you can deploy a disruptive technology platform, figure out how it will work in the healthcare system, bring it back to the developed world where, for example, at Mass General, the IT infrastructure is not as good as it could be because the switching costs are too high.
What do you mean by switching costs?
If I go to one of the best hospitals here in Boston today, one of the Harvard Medical School hospitals, there is a lot of history and infrastructure that's already been existing for many years. If there is a brand new technology such as our handheld device, there is a lot of pipelines of infrastructure and hospital administration that's already established along the old technology. There are a bunch of jobs that depend on it. And to completely disrupt that with a new technology is sometimes threatening.
Switching to the new way of doing things, it's disruptive, as you say,
right.
Totally disruptive. Now, picture a village, and there are millions of them in Asia. How will this new technology be used, do you imagine?
Well, imagine in a village where there's a problem with sanitation, hygiene, there's people, kids dying of infectious disease, high infant mortality, and there's a huge unmet need. There's no hospital, there's no pathology lab in the village. There may be a social healthcare worker who comes once a month to check if somebody has some nasty, deadly disease and transports blood samples back to some city facility that maybe in the scorching desert heat get damaged along the way or they never get the information back. So imagine getting rid of all that overhead infrastructure and just having a simple handheld device that you could take with you to the village that a minimally trained person, you know, who's not sophisticated and their training could use to get some feedback as to whether they're infected with some nasty disease.
It's a portable laboratory.
That's right.
And then they presumably take it to a doctor or some healthcare system and say,
well,
this is what we've got.
It empowers people to have information about their own health. And then they can use that information to seek out the right medications or the pharmaceutical therapies. But at least when you have that information, you can go and seek the therapy.
Where is this gigantic plant, 750 acres in India?
Well, 500 acres are near this area called Baddi, which they're dubbing kind of the new Bangalore in India, and 250 acres in the upper Himalayas, in a beautiful sort of paradise-looking place with mountains and lakes where we would like to establish a medical resort where the best of Western and Eastern medicine with a focus on nano medical applications can be developed.
Is it slightly poignant for you being from India yourself originally?
Well, my parents came from India. I'm born and bred in the USA. But yes, absolutely. I've always lived in the juxtaposition of these two cultures, the US and India, and believe very strongly that there is a tremendous synergy when we can harness talents from both Eastern and Western worlds. I think there's a tremendous amount of energy in these developing, emerging economies, and there's a tremendous amount of expertise and wisdom in places like the U.S. and a lot of focus on innovation, at least traditionally. And so if we can harness the best of both of these worlds, we can together build a better world.
Dr. Anita Gowell, the CEO of NanoBioSim, and her business card says, "Where little things make a big difference." She's in Boston. And in Canberra, Professor Jagadish has similar thoughts about India and energy from nano.
Robin, as you know, the energy is becoming a real and important global issue. And there are two issues one need to really understand in terms of energy. One is the energy generation, where the nanotechnology plays a very important role. And the other area is the efficiency at which we are using these energy resources. For example, solid-state lighting, where again we are using nanotechnology where we can make these solid-state white lights, which will be more efficient than our incandescent lamps. Thereby, they will reduce power consumption, in turn will reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And also, more importantly, these solid-state lamps are expected to last for about 20 to 25 years, so indicating that you don't need to go and keep on changing the bulbs.
Yeah, we've talked before about the potential of places in Asia leapfrogging the smokestack economies of the 19th and even the 20th centuries and going straight to this very, very appropriate technology level. Is that happening already?
There are some things happening. As you mentioned earlier, India, for example, India never had very good telephone infrastructure. And when the technology developments are taking place, and Indians haven't gone and then tried to put big, large copper wire networks, they've straight away gone to the mobile phones. And an average Indian, when I go and see people, and they have got 2-3 mobile phones, and even an auto rickshaw driver is using his mobile phone and then telling the customers at what time he will come and pick them up.
And presumably you're keeping in touch so that you can share the potential of the technology when you're working here at the ANU.
Yes, and we do have very strong contacts with India, and also at the moment we have got the Australia-India Strategic Research Fund, which is supported by the federal government, and then it also tries to provide some research project funding to enhance further links between Australian researchers and the Indian researchers. You can now imagine a person who is living in a tin shed and may not have all the luxuries which we all have here, but at the same time, this person could potentially have a small solar panel made out of the nanotechnologies and then use a white light LED-based light source for lighting his or her own home without having to go and pay large sums of electricity bills for the corporate sector.
Yes, let me just ask you a question that arose from a program on the Science Show a few weeks ago involving Ray Kurzweil. Now, he's an engineer, and he seemed to be saying something that was almost outrageous, and that is when you apply nanotechnology to the solar cell of the future, you could get the same sort of progress as you have in information technology, where the multiplying effect means that the sheer power of the technology goes up exponentially, but the cost goes in the opposite direction and becomes less and less. And he was saying that in 20 years' time, if it followed that pattern, you could have even up to 100% of our needs being realised from solar technology. Do you think that's an outrageous promise?
It is probably a little bit optimistic prediction, but at the same time, the nanotechnology is making a significant impact in terms of the solar energy sector. Just to give an example, and whenever we used to talk about the silicon solar cell technology, and we used to talk about the payback time in terms of energy and then the cost of the silicon solar panels is estimated to be something like 10 to 12 years or so. Of course, these panels can last for 20 to 25 years, so that means still you're able to use these panels for a long time. But recently, when we were discussing about the dye solar cells, which have been discovered by Michael Gretzel at Ecole Polytechnique in Lausanne, and he's been giving some numbers where he's saying that these solar cells could potentially give a payback time of 1 year. Even I was surprised that the payback time is so short. And then he told me that those numbers were not generated by himself, but these numbers were generated by a Dutch energy institute, independently came up with various solar cell technologies. What is the energy payback time for each one?
Professor Chunapati Jagadish at the ANU is a Federation Fellow. And back in Australia, our solar technology has some very strong Chinese connections you may know about. This report from Nicola Phillips.
Australia is one of the hottest and driest nations in the world. Perfect conditions for skin cancer, drought, and solar cells. There's certainly no shortage of skin cancer, and we have had our fair share of droughts. Yet less than a tenth of 1% of households or businesses use solar cells to generate power. In light of global warming, you think we would be embracing this renewable technology. Let me describe a solar cell. Imagine a small disc made from silicon that looks a lot like a CD. They work by capturing photons, energy-carrying particles from the sun's rays. Photons release electrons, and when you've got enough of them, you've got electricity. The beauty of this technology is that photons are free. No fuel or resource is consumed, no emissions are produced. Not only does Australia have perfect conditions for solar technology, but it has also produced some of the world's best photovoltaic engineers. Last year, Zhengrong Shi, a former student at the University of New South Wales, became the richest man in China with his solar cell company, SunTech. It is Shi's former teacher, Martin Green, who currently holds the world record for the most efficient silicon solar cells. The most obvious advantage of solar power is its limited impact on the environment. While everyone may not agree on the cause of global warming, the fact is the Earth is heating up. With climate change being blamed on increased emissions of greenhouse gases, scientists are looking to renewable energy sources to power our lives. At the moment in Australia, you can receive an $8,000 rebate for installing solar cells in your home or business. Another great bonus of these cells is their 25-year warranty. What else but a saucepan has that kind of guarantee? A common idea about solar power is that your house will only have electricity while the sun is shining. This simply isn't true. Any energy you don't use during the day is stored for use at night or when the sky is overcast. But if, for argument's sake, it rained for a month, you'll still be connected to the mains power grid for backup electricity. Professor Green, who has had solar cells powering his house for the last 7 years, says that while he's never been without electricity since their installation, he certainly pays more attention to the weather report. But what about the environment? All this talk of money makes you forget why we should install solar cells in the first place. Besides the no consumption, no emissions advantage, one of the ingenious features of solar cells is if you produce more electricity than you use, the excess will go back into the power grid to power someone else's home. You'll also get a credit on your next electricity bill. Not only are you saving money, but less electricity is being produced from burning coal. It's a win-win situation. So why haven't solar cells taken off in Australia? For one thing, most people know little to nothing about them. Solar cells and the $8,000 rebate have had minimal publicity. But even if solar cell technology was splashed over every available media outlet, there is only a limited pool of money to reimburse those who take the plunge. Why is there no money? Part of the reason has been the limited government support of this growing industry. Big companies have had little incentive to invest in the technology. Australia should look to countries like Germany for direction. Professor Green explains that their rebate scheme isn't a one-off payment like Australia's, but a continued payment per unit of electricity placed back into the power grid. Essentially, you can continue to make money from your solar system for the lifetime of the cells. According to Professor Green, for solar cells to have a substantial impact in Australia's energy supply, the government needs to get behind it. Because our former government's priority was with coal, one of our biggest exports, more focus was placed on transforming coal into a clean energy source than investing in new, non-established, renewable energy systems. However, times they are a-changing, and the federal government's announcement for plans to build Australia's largest solar power station in South Australia is a step in the right direction. Because what could be better than a technology that is clean, green, and infinitely renewable?
And increasingly nano. That was Nikki Phillips, who graduates this month in science at the University of New South Wales. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where small is very big, like the nano work of Professor Yannick at MIT. He's Turkish, by the way, putting a nano worm in a chip to operate. I'm rather surprised by the fact that you, an electrical engineer, are working on the nervous system of an animal, so you're doing biological work. How did that come to be?
Well, that was a long-standing interest I had in biology. I didn't want to do biology the usual way it is done because I thought there are enough people doing it, and I tried to bring new technologies to solve some of the challenging questions.
Well, these new technologies are really astonishing. I've just been to your lab and I've seen the way that you have a kind of chip into which you put the nematode worm, these tiny, tiny microscopic worms, which is difficult enough in the first place. But then you can use various techniques to have a kind of glowing nervous system. You can actually see the nervous system illuminated in a kind of bright green. You can see the wiring. And then you can use tiny pulses of laser light in incredibly short bursts to cut the nervous system and then watch it regenerate. I mean, that's an amazing process, getting it really down to the nano scale. Was it very difficult to develop this technology?
Well, to be able to manipulate the animals, we developed microchip technologies. These are used for fabrication of the chips that we use in our computers, but they are modified versions of them. And to be able to cut individual nerve processes at such a high precision, we basically applied femtosecond laser pulses.
Femtosecond is unbelievably fast, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's a zillion billionth of a second.
That's true. It's about 10 to the power minus 15th of a second, which is, yes, it's enormous. Millionth times.
And you can actually cut a chromosome. You're actually operating, doing surgery at the molecular level.
With this technology, we can cut individual nanoscale connections that connect individual neurons to each of them. For example, we can knock out synaptic junctions, we can knock out axonal connections. These are connections that neurons use to communicate with each other. And we can study various questions. We can, for example, ask the question, how they regenerate after such a physical injury? Or we can ask the question, how the nervous system works? By basically taking out pieces of a Lego, then you can start decrypting how it works.
And when the nematode worms cut, nervous system regenerates, does it do so in a short time?
Yes, it is amazingly short. It's about in 12 hours. And it is very powerful because with this technique, we can study neural regeneration on a large scale very rapidly. And the reason it generates so fast is not because its biology is much different than ours, but because the distances they need to generate is a lot shorter than our nervous system.
I see. And so it regenerates automatically, it rewires automatically. You don't have to do anything.
We don't have to do anything. But the nice thing is it neither generates perfectly or doesn't generate at all. It's partial. So what we are trying to do now is trying to understand whether we can enhance its regeneration or discover factors that inhibit its regeneration.
I see. The big puzzle was that if you want to study regeneration in a nervous system, and I see that you had a picture of Christopher Reeve, Superman, and the figures of the number of people who, I think it's 400,000 people in the United States who are injured in this way, and they've got nervous systems which don't work, they're paraplegic or quadriplegic. But our nervous systems are different. They're bigger, they're insulated with myelin, so you've got a different kind, you've also got a bigger wire to look at. Do you think that what you find in the nematode worm will be enough to give you clues about how our system works?
That's an excellent question. So first of all, like you mentioned, it doesn't have, C. elegans doesn't have this myelin sheet. It has some sort of a glial sheeting, but it's not like the myelin in our system has. But there are several questions that we haven't been able to discover in higher organisms. For example, we don't yet understand the full mechanism of intrinsic factors that control neural regeneration. And we can study those questions very easily in C. elegans. The other thing that our lab is doing, we are also developing high-throughput screening technologies using microchips again by using human embryonic stem cell-derived neurons. This way, we are basically able to transfer our findings in C. elegans and test them very rapidly on a human tissue very, very quickly.
I must say, C. elegans is the good Latin name of the worm, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Now, you've just published the paper in the proceedings of the Academy of Science in America. What's the next stage? Having done so much with the worm, how are you going to enhance this work?
So our first publication was a demonstration of the technology. The next stage is we are going to start performing very large-scale screens. So we are going to basically turn off every single gene one by one and ask how neural regeneration is affected by different genes. And then we are also going to perform similar screens using drug libraries, for instance. We will be able to, with this technology, for the first time on an animal, we will be able to perform a screen that involves hundreds of thousands or even millions of compounds very rapidly.
And just imagine a picture, because genetic systems, they're maps of fuses turning things on and off. I should imagine if you find ways in which you can turn on and off particular genes that connect to the nervous system in this nematode worm, and also understand the chemical systems involved, you could then look at other animals like us.
That's correct. That's exactly what we are going to do next. So as you say, once we discover something in C. elegans, which is actually an animal model, very rapidly, then we can test those candidates on this human tissue very quickly.
Very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It really is incredible technology, nanosurgery on a microscopic worm. Mehmet Yanik is a professor of electrical engineering at MIT. And this is Richard Kaner with the hard stuff, harder than diamond.
So we've developed a material basically by taking a transition metal and putting in short covalent bonds, rhenium diboride. And it's quite hard. In fact, it's sufficiently hard that it scratches diamond. We were challenged on that recently, and we used the modern tools of atomic force microscopy to actually show the indentation as we came across it. And so you can find that actually in Science magazine, and there's about 6 months previously we had shown the original scratching of diamond with this material. There's very few materials that do that.
When you don't want to scratch diamond, what would you use this ultra-hard material for?
Well, we're hoping it can be used as scratch-resistant coatings, ultra-hard coatings for materials. It turns out that rhenium is a bit expensive, and so we either have to find another material to substitute it or just use small amounts as in coatings.
Well, that's Rick Kaner at UCLA. Apart from the hard stuff, he makes intelligent materials in a hookup with Wollongong, two kinds of marvellous stuff, including, would you believe, artificial muscle.
That's right. I work on making new materials. So we both have an interest in conducting polymers. These are plastics that conduct electricity. And we developed a very simple way to make nanofibers or nanowires of these. And because of that, they go into water. And one of the problems with conducting polymers is they're not very useful because they don't disperse and they don't melt. But we can put them in water, we can deposit them on substrates, and then just with an ordinary camera flash, we can cause them to melt. And by doing that, we can melt the top surface but not the bottom. So imagine having a bottom surface that's nanofibers, a top surface that's welded. And then if you put that in acid, the bottom will pick up the acid and expand, the top cannot. So the object must bend. And so a 3-centimeter length piece of film will rotate around itself twice, so 720 degrees. And if you put it in base, it unwinds. So imagine your hand closing and opening. And so essentially what we've done, we've made a mechanical actuator, which is really an artificial muscle.
Fantastic. And what do you use an artificial muscle for?
Well, hopefully in the future, if people need limbs fixed up, that this would be one way of doing it, or things that respond to an electrical signal or an optical signal where you could remotely control something. So there's a lot of actuators in use, but one would like to be able to do this with plastics because they're cheap.
And better than doing it with pulleys and levers and that sort of thing, rather less subtly.
That's the idea, to replace more expensive metals with cheaper plastics.
That was one example. What's the second?
The second is single-layer graphite, known as graphene. So graphite's the stuff in pencils that you can write because the layers slide off. Well, a couple of years ago, it was discovered that if you kept taking a piece of graphite with Scotch tape and pulling layers off, that eventually you could get to a single layer. And that single layer had very special electronic properties. You can make transistors out of it. Except the trouble is, imagine trying to scale up these transistors using Scotch tape and peeling one after the other. It may take you days or weeks to actually get a decent piece to make a transistor. So we started working with the group in Australia on methods for scaling this up. And we actually found a method where we can take graphite, large amount of it, we can intercalate different ions, put them between the layers, we can then blow the layers apart in water, we can reduce the material back to sheets of graphene. And one of my postdocs, Dr. Dan Lee, has joined Gordon Wallace's group, and he's an expert in colloid science, basically particles dispersed in water.
A bit like milk.
Exactly. Milk is a colloid between fat and water. So imagine that, but now having individual sheets of graphite. And so we've made these dispersions of graphite in water. We can put them on any surface, and basically a paper describing this will come out in the next couple of weeks in the journal Nature Nanotechnology.
And what can you see that being used for in 10, 20 years' time?
Well, I mentioned transistors. So the hope is that someday in the not-too-distant future, silicon chips are reaching the limit of how small they can get. And so if you could replace some of the silicon-based electronics with carbon-based electronics, they could shrink even further. So that's the hope. But probably more realistic is these carbon could be put down as conducting pads, conducting wires. And if they're thin and fairly transparent, you can start thinking of using them to help solar cells. Because solar cells, you need a conducting material. And it'd be nice, instead of using metal wires, to use a carbon-based film that was highly transparent. So those are some of the applications we hope to see in 10 or 20 years.
Well, that's carbon in the traditional sense. There's also another kind of carbon called buckyballs, you know, Buckminster fullerene. Do you have anything to do with that stuff?
There's a superconducting form of Buckminster fullerene if you put in potassium. And so the superconducting form was originally discovered at Bell Labs, but we had the ability to make the first pure samples of that superconductor and characterize it. And so the structure is actually over in my office, made up of soccer balls.
I can see it up there, the yellow soccer balls run on top of each other.
And I'll tell you a funny story. In order to make that structure, the unit cell has 14 soccer balls in it. And so I wanted to make a life-size model so when I'm teaching class, I can show the relationship of the balls and their ordering. And so I went to the local toy store, and I picked out 14 soccer balls and filled my shopping cart with it. And while I was waiting in line to check out, the person in front of me kept looking back and looking back, and he said, "I just have to ask you one question." I'm like, "What's that?" He said, "Are you the coach of a Little League soccer team?" And I said, "No, actually, I'm doing a science project." But what I didn't tell him is that I was a university professor at a public university, because I figured he'd wonder what his tax dollars were going to pay for.
I can imagine. Well, the potential there is amazing. But looking forward, really, as Gordon Wallace has often done, to a world that's somewhat different in 10-odd years' time, if you imagine intelligent materials, say, here in your office, which can respond to both the chemicals around and also the light, the pollution, who knows what, and adjust things. Have you been thinking in those kind of bigger terms about what the home, what the city, what the world might be like in a few years' time once these intelligent materials and responsive materials are displayed all around?
Well, I think the first applications of smart materials are really essentially passive materials. They're ones like, if you think about your windows, and if you embed particles in that, as light shines on it during the summer, it will reflect the light, and during the winter it will let it in. So during the winter it will keep you warm, and during the summer it will keep you cool. Those are the kinds of things that are beginning to be done, and those are smart materials in a sense. Even putting fibers of conducting polymers or carbon into carpeting so one doesn't get a shock from the static that builds up is an advance. But I mean, I think what people are hoping to see is that you'll have materials that will tell you when they're fatiguing. You'll have materials that will tell you they're in need of service. And so that's active response materials rather than a passive response.
Richard Kaner, Professor of Chemistry at UCLA, who tells me Gordon Wallace in Wollongong is now working on nano connections for the bionic ear. Meanwhile, at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales, Dr. Erica Wanless is also doing nanochemistry with surfaces.
Well, we usually take dry, pristine surface like some mica or some silica wafer, so that's very smooth. With mica, it would be atomically smooth. With silicon wafer, it's very, very smooth, less than 1 nanometer roughness. Then, depending on which instrument we're studying that interface with, we will immerse that surface in a solution where water is the solvent, always in our case, and the solution also will contain surfactant molecules, where surfactants are like your everyday detergent molecules.
I've got them in my lungs.
You have them in your lungs. We have, in fact, all of our cell membranes are made of lipids, which are the biological equivalent molecules, but they all have the same characteristic in that they're driven to congregate at phase boundaries. So we expose the solution containing these surfactant molecules to that surface, and we use optical reflectometry basically to count the number of molecules that are sitting at the interface.
You can actually count molecules?
Yeah, you get a concentration of molecules at the interface.
So you're making a package which is designed to perform a particular function?
Yes, we're looking to coat the surface with these polymeric surfactants in solution. They have pockets of oil-loving core material surrounded by a much more water-loving, we call it the corona. And what that means is that if you have also in the solution a molecule that would rather be in an oil-containing environment, it'll be driven to the core of these nanometer-sized objects.
So you've got something in a little container hidden there, and it's formed almost like a pill.
Yep, it's partitioning of the oil-loving material into the core, or encapsulated. That oil-loving material could be something ultimately like a drug. It could be something ultimately like a topical cosmetic for controlled release of moisturiser. Anything that really doesn't like to be in water can be micro-partitioned into these little zones.
So you put it on and put it in, and at a particular time you give the signal and it's released.
Yeah, so in our case, the signal is usually a change in pH, not a very big change in pH.
Acidity, alkalinity.
Yes, and the core can open up and release then those molecules that have been entrained back into the solution.
Why do you want to smuggle them in like that? Why not just put the killer drug or whatever it is where you want it?
Well, in that whole zone of drug delivery, oftentimes, for example, the drug might be very toxic. So if you can have it encapsulated until it gets to the site of interest, then you can use a lower dose, which is much better for the patient. It also can mean that it's released slowly rather than getting a huge spike in concentration of that drug, which isn't necessarily useful for the treatment of that disease. And the same thing applies if we're not talking about drugs. If we're talking about cosmetics, or if you look at a lot of, there's lots of capsules in like shower gels and all sorts of things that are there, say, or in conditioner to slowly release onto your hair some other material. It's really about delivery from one place to the next in a controlled fashion.
Instead of a blunderbuss.
That's correct.
When will you have it on the market?
Well, this has been quite fundamental studies that we've been working on, but I am talking with, for example, paint companies. Modern paints are quite high technologies, and in order to have water-based paints that have got ultimately the right gloss and all of these things, you often have coatings of this type.
Well, give me an idea. When, if you've got everything from paints to pharmaceuticals, it could be this area of nanochemistry, if I may call it such, a really huge industrial potential.
Yes, well, I'm part of a very big field which is in surface and colloid science, and that does range in everything from mineral processing, particularly in this country, through to foodstuffs and cosmetics and drug delivery. So we're not about making new molecules, we're about harnessing molecules that other people have synthesised and getting them to where they need to be. If it's in, say, in the food industry, making products that have got longer shelf lives. So you don't, for example, want the fats in your milk to separate, you don't want the solid particles in your soy milk to separate, you don't want your mayonnaise to separate. It's the same sort of technology that we're using here, is to control interfacial energy.
A few weeks ago I had someone, actually a physical chemist, talking about Friends of the Earth in Europe, warning against nanoparticles that seem to be part of the package these days and which might not be as benign as some people hoped. Have you been looking at that?
No, I haven't been. I'm aware of those arguments, and like with any technology, you have to have all your checks and balances in place. But a lot of the things I'm talking about, it's nothing new. We're not making nanoparticles. We're just possibly controlling how stable they are in a dispersion. So while, say, the drug industry is going to have very careful checks and balances and through to clinical trials, we need to do that with a whole range of products. The reason the argument is there is that materials on the nanoscale are not necessarily the same as their bulk parent material. And so the reason for that is that They have got very small particles, they've got a very high surface area to volume ratio. That means there are many more surface atoms than bulk atoms, and those surface atoms have got strains in their bonds, which mean they're at higher energy. And so when you get more of those in the population of atoms, even if it's something that might normally be a rock that's very benign sitting out there in nature, if it's in very tiny particles, you have to understand its physical chemistry and surface chemistry to know how it will behave, because it is a slightly different material.
Erica Wanless is a professor of chemistry at the University of Newcastle, making chemical packages at the nanoscale. And you can also do that with vaccines, except the packaging in this case is a virus. Sarah Young in Dunedin is using the Khaleesi virus for this unlikely treatment.
Well, the virus infects rabbits, that's the natural host, and it causes a hemorrhagic disease. So basically they bleed out of orifices and they die very quickly. But we are using it in our own research in humans, and it's, humans aren't a natural host of Khaleesi virus, so it doesn't cause a productive infection in humans, but we can use it as a vehicle to introduce different antigens from infectious diseases and tumours into the human host.
Now, I don't look like a rabbit, but mammals are pretty much the same. I'm rather surprised that you can tell me that a Khaleesi virus, which you use as a sort of Trojan horse to get another kind of vaccine into my body, won't affect me in any way. How do you know?
Well, we've tried it in cells, so it doesn't cause an active infection and cause killing or lysis of cells in a culture. So it doesn't do that with human cells. And I mean, that's the way we know. And we also know, obviously, the farmers that released them in Otago in New Zealand here, I mean, none of them got a productive infection or got any sign of disease. And they were introducing huge virus titers into the environment.
And of course, what you need to do is to get the vaccine to the right place in the human body. And I've heard of some people who've used even a denatured AIDS virus.
Yes, people are using attenuated viruses, so denatured or heat-killed viruses. So they're viruses and they're used in routine, like for example the influenza vaccine. So denatured viruses are used a lot in vaccines. So they can't infect a cell, but they can provide all the proteins that you might make an immune response to.
And they can get in, can't they?
They can get into your body when you inject through a needle. However, it's your phagocytic cells, certain cells that will pick it up and eat them, and that's how they get into the cells.
What would happen if you just squirted the vaccine in without that carrier?
So we've tried this with the virus-like particle. We have a project looking at transcutaneous vaccination and also vaccination across the mucosa, so up the nose, for example, and we know that we need some sort of adjuvant to help it get across that layer of skin or that, you know, the mucous membrane.
And what sort of vaccines are you taking into people?
The main thrust of our research at the moment is to use these virus-like particles as carriers for tumour proteins, and we're trying to make tumour therapies and also vaccines against tumours, so to prevent tumours. So we've got those in preclinical trials at the moment where we're using them in vitro cultures, but the idea is that we'll use them eventually in humans. So we'll initially make tailor-made vaccines. So I've got a collaboration with my old work in the UK for Cancer Research UK, where a patient will come in, we'll resect out the tumour, we'll load those tumour antigens onto the VLP, and then we'll use that to re-inject back into the patient to try and tickle their immune system along and generate a strong immune response to that particular tumour that they've got.
And by their extract of tumour, they'll kill the tumour themselves in the end.
Yes, that's exactly right. So we're trying to make the immune response seem like an infectious disease. So normally you get quite tolerized to your own tumour, and tumours have ways of dampening down the immune response. So you need something to really kick the immune response into gear, and this is a way that we do that.
Is it working?
Well, we haven't tried it in vivo yet, but it certainly is looking good in the animal models that we've got of tumours. We've got it working very nicely in a melanoma model, and we are trying it in some colorectal models as well, but we've just got another lot of research money to do exactly that. So basically, if you were to ask me this question in another 2 years' time, I might be able to answer it.
That's a date. Dr. Sarah Young is a microbiologist at the University of Otago in New Zealand. A science show voyage around some very small particles forming a massive part of global research in a variety of fields. Next week we shall visit Mythbusters and discuss the 10 topics science can't tackle, according to Mike Hanlon, like whether your dog has a sense of humour. Production today by David Fisher and Charlie McCune, both of whom have a sense of humour, but no dog. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.